Chapter 4. I sat down to write gravely and sadly, for since the appearance of some of my adventures in a monthly magazine, unprincipled men have endeavored to rob me of the only good I possess, to question the statements that I make, and, themselves without a spark of honor or good feeling, to steal from me that which is my sole wealth, my character as a teller of the truth. The reader will understand that it is to the liberal strictures of a profligate press I now allude. Among the London journalists, none, luckily for themselves, have dared to question the veracity of my statements. They know me, and they know that I am in London. If I can use the pen, I can also wield a more manly and terrible weapon, and would answer their contradictions with my sword. No gold or gems adorn the hilt of that war-worn scimitar, but there is blood upon the blade, the blood of the enemies of my country, and the maligners of my honest fame. There are others, however, the disgrace of a disgraceful trade who, borrowing from distance a despicable courage, have ventured to assail me. The infamous editors of the Kelso Champion, the Bungay Beacon, the Tipperary Argus, and the Stoke Podgers Sentinel, and other dastardly organs of the provincial press, have, although differing in politics, agreed upon this one point, and, with a scoundrelly unanimity, vented a flood of abuse upon the revelations made by me. They say that I have assailed private characters, and willfully perverted history, to blacken the reputation of public men. I ask, was any one of these men in Bengal in the year 1803? Was any single conductor of any one of these paltry prints ever in Bundelkhand or the Rohilla country? Does this exquisite Tipperary scribe know the difference between Urigurbang and Burmtala? Not he. And because, forsooth, in those strange and distant lands strange circumstances have taken place, it is insinuated that the relator is a liar. Nay, that the very places themselves have no existence but in my imagination. Fools! But I will not waste my anger upon them, and proceed to recount some other portions of my personal history. It is, I presume, a fact which even these scribbling assassins will not venture to deny, that before the commencement of the campaign against Scindia, the English general formed a camp at Cannauge on the Jumna, where he exercised that brilliant little army which was speedily to perform such wonders in the Duab. It will be as well to give a slight account of the causes of a war which was speedily to rage through some of the fairest portions of the Indian continent. Shalom, the son of Shalalam, the descendant by the female line of Nader Shah, that celebrated Turkoman adventurer, who had well nigh hurled Bajazid and Selim II from the throne of Baghdad. Shalom, I say, although nominally the emperor of Delhi, was in reality the slave of the various warlike chieftains who lorded it by turns over the country and the sovereign, until conquered and slain by some more successful rebel. Chowder Lol Masal G, Zubardust Khan, Docent Rosendaya, and the celebrated Babaji Jung Bahadur, had held for a time complete mastery in Delhi. The second of these, a ruthless Afghan soldier, had abruptly entered the capital, nor was he ejected from it until he had seized upon the principal jewels, and likewise put out the eyes of the last of the unfortunate family of Afrasiab. Scindia came to the rescue of the sightless Shalom, and though he destroyed his oppressor, only increased his slavery, holding him in as painful a bondage as he had suffered under the tyrannous Afghan. As long as these heroes were battling among themselves, or as long rather as it appeared that they had any strength to fight a battle, the British government, ever anxious to see its enemies by the ears, by no means interfered in the contest. But the French Revolution broke out, and a host of starving sans-culottes appeared among the various Indian states, seeking for military service, and inflaming the minds of the various native princes against the British East India Company. A number of these entered into Scindia's ranks. One of them, Perrin, was commander of his army, and though that chief was as yet quite engaged in his hereditary quarrel with Jeswant Roe Holker, and never thought of an invasion of the British territory. The company all of a sudden discovered that Shah Alam, his sovereign, was shamefully ill-used, and determined to re-establish the ancient splendor of his throne. Of course, it was sheer benevolence for poor Shah Alam that prompted our governors to take these kindly measures in his favor. I don't know how it happened that, at the end of the war, the poor Shah was not a whit better off than at the beginning, and that though Holker was beaten and Sindhia annihilated, Shah Alam was much such a puppet as before. Somehow, in the hurry and confusion of this struggle, the oyster remained with the British government, who had so kindly offered to dress it for the Emperor, while His Majesty was obliged to be contented with the shell. The force encamped at Kanauj bore the title of the Grand Army of the Ganges and the Jumna. It consisted of 11 regiments of cavalry and 12 battalions of infantry, and was commanded by General Lake in person. Well, on the 1st of September we stormed Perrin's camp at Aligarh. On the 4th we took that fortress by assault, and as my name was mentioned in general orders, I may as well quote the commander-in-chief's words regarding me: they will spare me the trouble of composing my own eulogium. The commander-in-chief is proud thus publicly to declare his high sense of the gallantry of Lieutenant Gahagan, of the cavalry. In the storming of the fortress, although unprovided with a single ladder, and accompanied but by a few brave men, Lieutenant Gahagan succeeded in escalading the inner and 14th wall of the place. 14 ditches lined with sword blades and poisoned chevaux de frise, 14 walls bristling with innumerable artillery, and as smooth as looking glasses, were in turn triumphantly passed by that enterprising officer. His course was to be traced by the heaps of slaughtered enemies lying thick upon the platforms, and alas, by the corpses of most of the gallant men who followed him. When at length he effected his lodgment, and the dastardly enemy, who dared not to confront him with arms, let loose upon him the tigers and lions of Sindhia's menagerie, this meritorious officer destroyed, with his own hand, 4 of the largest and most ferocious animals, and the rest, awed by the indomitable majesty of British valor, shrank back to their dens. Thomas Higgory, a private, and Runty Goss, a wielder, were the only 2 who remained out of the 900 who followed Lieutenant Gahagan. Honor to them. Honor and tears for the brave men who perished on that awful day. Asterisk, 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 I have copied this, word for word, from the Bengal Hurkaru of September 24, 1803. And anybody who has the slightest doubt as to the statement may refer to the paper itself. And here I must pause to give thanks to fortune, which so marvelously preserved me, Sergeant Major Higgory, and Runty Goss. Were I to say that any valor of ours had carried us unhurt through this tremendous combat, the reader would laugh me to scorn. No. Though my narrative is extraordinary, it is nevertheless authentic. And never, never would I sacrifice truth for the mere sake of effect. The fact is this. The citadel of Aligarh is situated upon a rock, about 1,000 feet above the level of the sea, and is surrounded by 14 walls, as His Excellency was good enough to remark in his dispatch. A man who would mount these without scaling ladders is an ass. He who would say he mounted them without such assistance is a liar and a knave. We had scaling ladders at the commencement of the assault, although it was quite impossible to carry them beyond the first line of batteries. Mounted on them, however, as our troops were falling thick about me, I saw that we must ignominiously retreat, unless some other help could be found for our brave fellows to escalate the next wall. It was about 70 feet high. I instantly turned the guns of wall A on wall B, and peppered the ladder so as to make, not a breach, but a scaling place, the men mounting in the holes made by the shot. By this simple stratagem, I managed to pass each successive barrier for, to ascend a wall which the general was pleased to call as smooth as glass is an absurd impossibility. I seek to achieve none such. I dare do all that may become a man Who dares do more, is neither more nor less. Of course, had the enemy's guns been commonly well served, not one of us would ever have been alive out of the three. But whether it was owing to fright, or to the excessive smoke caused by so many pieces of artillery, arrive we did. On the platforms too, our work was not quite so difficult as might be imagined. Killing these fellows was sheer butchery. As soon as we appeared, they all turned and fled helter-skelter, and the reader may judge of their courage by the fact that out of about 700 men killed by us, only 40 had wounds in front, the rest being bayoneted as they ran. And beyond all other pieces of good fortune was the very letting out of these tigers, which was the Dernier Essert of Burnonville, the second commandant of the fort. I had observed this man, conspicuous for a tricolored scarf which he wore, upon every one of the walls as we stormed them, and running away the very first among the fugitives. He had all the keys of the gates, and in his tremor, as he opened the menagerie portal, left the whole bunch in the door, which I seized when the animals were overcome. Runty Goss then opened them one by one, our troops entered, and the victorious standard of my country floated on the walls of Eliger. When the general, accompanied by his staff, entered the last line of fortifications, the brave old man raised me from the dead rhinoceros on which I was seated, and pressed me to his breast. But the excitement which had borne me through the fatigues and perils of that fearful day failed all of a sudden, and I wept like a child upon his shoulder. Promotion, in our army, goes unluckily by seniority, nor is it in the power of the general-in-chief to advance a Caesar, if he finds him in the capacity of a subaltern. My reward for the above exploit was, therefore, not very rich. His Excellency had a favorite horn snuff box, for, though exalted in station, he was in his habits most simple, colon of this, and about a quarter of an ounce of high dried Welsh, which he always took, he made me a present, saying, in front of the line, accept this, Mr. Gahagan, as a token of respect from the first to the bravest officer in the army. Calculating the snuff to be worth a halfpenny, I should say that fourpence was about the value of this gift. But it has at least this good effect: it serves to convince any person who doubts my story that the facts of it are really true. I have left it at the office of my publisher, along with the extract from the Bengal Hercaru, and anybody may examine both by applying in the counting house of Mr. Cunningham. 3. That once popular expression, or proverb, "Are you up to snuff?" arose out of the above circumstance. For the officers of my corps, none of whom, except myself, had ventured on the storming party, used to twit me about this modest reward for my labors. Never mind. When they want me to storm a fort again, I shall know better. Well, immediately after the capture of this important fortress, Perrin, who had been the life and soul of Scindia's army, came into us, with his family and treasure, and was passed over to the French settlements at Chandernagar. Berquien took his command, and against him we now moved. The morning of the 11th of September found us upon the plains of Delhi. It was a burning hot day, and we were all refreshing ourselves after the morning's march, when I, who was on the advanced picket along with O'Galler of the King's Dragoons, was made aware of the enemy's neighborhood in a very singular manner. O'Galler and I were seated under a little canopy of horse cloths, which we had formed to shelter us from the intolerable heat of the sun, and were discussing with great delight a few Manila cheroots, and a stone jar of the most exquisite, cool, weak, refreshing sangaree. We had been playing cards the night before, and O'Galler had lost to me 700 rupees. I emptied the last of the sangaree into the two pint tumblers out of which we were drinking, and holding mine up, said, "Here's better luck to you next time, O'Galler." As I spoke the words "wish," a cannonball cut the tumbler clean out of my hand, and plumped into poor O'Galler's stomach. It settled him completely, and of course I never got my 700 rupees. Such are the uncertainties of war. To strap on my saber and my accoutrements, to mount my Arab charger to drink off what O'Galler had left of the sangaree, and to gallop to the general, was the work of a moment. I found him as comfortably at tiffin, as if he were at his own house in London. "General," said I, as soon as I got into his pajamas or tent, "you must leave your lunch, if you want to fight the enemy." "The enemy, sir?" "Mr. Gahagan, the enemy is on the other side of the river. I can only tell your excellency, that the enemy's guns will hardly carry 5 miles, and that Cornet O'Galler was this moment shot dead at my side with a cannonball."
"Ha, is it so?"
said his excellency, rising, and laying down the drumstick of a grilled chicken. "Gentlemen, remember that the eyes of Europe are upon us, and follow me." Each aide-de-camp started from table, and seized his cocked hat. Each British heart beat high at the thoughts of the coming melee. We mounted our horses, and galloped swiftly after the brave old general, I not the last in the train, upon my famous black charger. It was perfectly true, the enemy were posted in force within 3 miles of our camp, and from a hillock in the advance to which we galloped, we were enabled with our telescopes to see the whole of his imposing line. Nothing can better describe it than this. A dot 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 is the enemy, and the dots represent the 120 pieces of artillery which defended his line. He was moreover entrenched, and a wide morass in his front gave him an additional security. His excellency for a moment surveyed the line, and then said, turning round to one of his aides-de-camp, "Order up Major General Tinkler and the cavalry." "Here, does your excellency mean?" said the aide-de-camp, surprised, for the enemy had perceived us, and the cannonballs were flying about as thick as peas.
"Here, sir,"
said the old general, stamping with his foot in a passion, and the A.D.D.C. shrugged his shoulders and galloped away. In 5 minutes we heard the trumpets in our camp, and in 20 more the greater part of the cavalry had joined us. Up they came, 5,000 men, their standards flapping in the air, their long line of polished jackboots gleaming in the golden sunlight. "And now we are here," said Major General Sir Theophilus Tinkler, "what next?"
"H. D. it," said the Commander-in-Chief, "charge. Charge nothing like charging galloping guns, rascally black scoundrels, charge, charge." And then turning round to me, perhaps he was glad to change the conversation, he said, "Lieutenant Gahagan, you will stay with me." And well for him I did, for I do not hesitate to say that the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.